end until 11:30, and balls often continued through dawn, one wonders when Theodore ever found time to sleep. Early in the new year, after a full day in the law school and the library, a meeting with some old college friends to organize a free trade club, and an evening spent at the Astors, he noted delightedly in his diary, "Every moment of my time occupied." Should a spare moment occasionally present itself, he filled it not with rest, but work. Owen Wister has left an anecdote of this period, which reads like the opening scene of a Victorian drawing-room comedy. It is the pre-dinner hour. Theodore, standing on one leg at the bookcases in his New York house, is sketching a diagram for the Naval War of 1812. In rushes Alice, exclaiming in a plaintive drawl, "We're dining out in 20 minutes, and Teddy's drawing little ships!" But increasingly, as the season wore on, Theodore used the pre-dinner hour for another, more private activity, of which Mrs. Astor would definitely not have approved. Resplendent in evening dress, he would dash across Fifth Avenue, round the corner of 59th Street, and up a shabby flight of stairs. Morton Hall, as the headquarters of the 21st District Republican Association was grandly called, was a barn-sized chamber over a store. It was furnished with rough benches and spittoons, a raised table and a chair. Two gloomy political portraits completed the decor. Here the cheap lawyers, saloon keepers, and horse car conductors who ran Theodore's district, Irishmen mostly, met together for political meetings once or twice a month. On other nights, Morton Hall served as a sort of clubroom where the same clientele could chat informally. During these bull sessions, Celtic eloquence, punctuated by regular squirts of plug juice, tended to veer from politics to dirty stories. Theodore, whose distaste for tobacco matched his prudishness, must have winced many times during his first visits in the fall of 1880. He had been by no means welcome, for his side whiskers and evening clothes made the heelers uncomfortable. But he came back again and again until he was eventually accepted for membership in the association. When the news of Theodore's unseemly activities leaked out, his family reacted with almost uniform horror. "We thought he was, to put it frankly, pretty fresh," wrote Emlyn Roosevelt. "We felt that his own father would not have liked it, and would have been fearful of the outcome." The Roosevelt circle as a whole had a profound distrust of public life. So, too, did his father's friends, bankers, lawyers, businessmen, clubmen. Politics, they assured him from the depths of their leather armchairs, was low. A gentleman of his upbringing might subscribe to campaign funds without inquiring too closely as to how the money was spent, might even attend a primary or two, and of course he had a duty to cast his vote on election day, providing the weather was fine. But to traffic with men who were rough and brutal and unpleasant was decidedly infra-dig. He should not soil his kid gloves on the levers of political machinery. Theodore reacted with predictable anger. "I answered that if this was so, it merely meant that the people I knew did not belong to the governing class, and that the other people did, and that I intended to be one of the governing class. And if they proved too hard bit for me, I supposed I would have to quit, but that I certainly would not quit until I had made the effort and found out whether I really was too weak to hold my own in the rough and tumble." He could, of course, have entered the government the respectable way, by cultivating the society of men in leather armchairs, qualifying as a lawyer himself, and in 10 years or so, running for a seat in the United States Senate. But some instinct told him that if he desired raw political power, and from this winter on for the rest of his life, he never ceased to desire it, he must start on the shop floor, learn to work those greasy levers one by one. Besides, he had a private score to settle. It had been the New York State Republican machine, still controlled by boss Roscoe Conkling, that had destroyed Theodore Sr. Might not Theodore Jr., by mastering its techniques, use that same machine to avenge him? Among his father's letters, which he kept about him as talismans against evil, was one dated 16 December 1877, after Conkling's victory in the Senate. In the tired hand of a dying man, Theodore Sr. had written, "The machine politicians have shown their colors. I feel sorry for the country, however, as it shows the power of partisan politicians who think of nothing higher than their own interests, and I feel for your future. We cannot stand so corrupt a government for any great length of time." So the budding socialite turned his back on privilege and spent more and more time at Morton Hall. Despite the glory he later attained, the club he set never quite forgave him. He was considered a traitor to his caste, a man who should have been on the side of capital. Long after his death, when builders began to convert the Theodore Roosevelt birthplace into a national shrine, a family elder exclaimed, "I don't know why you are making such a fuss. I used to hate to see him coming down the street." The stout man who chaired meetings at Morton Hall from behind a stout pitcher of iced water was scarcely more pleased to hear Theodore's feet drumming up the stairs. Jake Hess was a self-made professional politician and had little use for amateurs in evening clothes. His German-Jewish heritage had not prevented him from elbowing aside many Irish Catholic challengers to win control of the 21st District. A loyal servant of the upstate Republican machine, Hess regularly supplied Albany with loyal, machine-minded assemblymen. Since the 21st was one of the few safe Republican districts in New York City, he was a man of unusual influence and pompously aware of it. At first, Theodore tried to cultivate Hess, but his efforts were received only with rather distant affability. The newcomer was forced to mingle instead with the rank and file of the party, and some were rank indeed, acquiring the political habit at the very lowest level. For most of the winter of 1880-81, he seemed content with this society. "I went around there often enough to have the men get accustomed to me and to have me get accustomed to them, so that we began to speak the same language, and so that each could begin to live down what Bret Harte has called the defective moral quality of being a stranger. It is not often that a man can make opportunities for himself, but he can put himself in such shape that when or if the opportunities come, he is ready to take advantage of them." By March, he was taking a more active role in party politics, attending a series of primaries in addition to regular meetings, working his way up into the executive committee of the Young Republicans, and presuming to address the association on its new charter. An opportunity for advancement, he thought, arose early in April. Theodore's only reference to it in his diary was, "Went to Republican primary, grand row, very hopeless." The story behind this cryptic entry is interesting, since it indicates that his very first political maneuver was in the direction of rebellion and reform. A citizens' movement was underway to introduce a nonpartisan street cleaning bill into the state legislature. Then, as always, the cleanliness of New York's streets varied according to who represented which district, and Theodore backed it. He made a speech on behalf of the bill at Morton Hall, and spoke with such force that he won several rounds of applause. By the time he sat down, he was the object of at least one man's thoughtful gaze. But the party machine was opposed to the measure, and on 5 May, Theodore found himself with only 6 or 7 votes out of 300 or 400. The young opportunist retired to lick his wounds. He did not go back to Morton Hall that spring. A few days later, the law school broke up, Lightfoot was dispatched to the country, and Mitty Roosevelt ordered the blinds drawn at 6 West 57th Street. Pausing only to dictate his will and pack 1,000 pounds of luggage, Theodore escorted Alice up the gangplank of the steamship Celtic on 12 May 1881. Hurrah for a summer abroad with the darling little wife! His euphoria dwindled before they were halfway across the Atlantic. "Confound a European trip, say I," he wrote in his diary. Alice, who had never been overseas before, was so consistently seasick that Theodore exhausted himself taking care of her. But Ireland, which they reached on 21 May, exerted its usual calming influence. They sailed smoothly up the River Lee to Cork and awoke the following morning, Sunday, to the sound of the bells of Shandon. Alice recovered immediately and was able to endure 10 days of riding on jaunting cars, ancient trains, and shaggy ponies with sweet equanimity. Meanwhile, Theodore reacted to everything with ears as well as eyes. He praised the birdsong and wildflowers at Castle Blarney, enjoyed the silence and many-colored mountains around Killarney, and thrilled to the echoing cliffs of Dunloe's Gap. Unlike most visitors, he investigated some of the uglier aspects of life on the Emerald Isle. A heap of dirty rags on the road to Cork turned out to be a tramp, insensible from sheer hunger. With the help of some peasants, he revived the man, fed him, and sent him on his way with 10 shillings. "A beautiful country," Theodore concluded, "but with a terrible understratum of wretchedness." By the end of the month, when they embarked on a glassy sea for England, Alice had become the best traveling companion he had ever known. Being athletically inclined, she was game for the most arduous excursions, yet was feminine enough to pretend helplessness while he juggled with suitcases, tickets, and hack drivers. "Baby enjoys everything immensely," he wrote after a marathon tour of the London galleries, "and has a far keener appreciation of most of the pictures than I have." Theodore's own taste, on this third exposure to the art of Europe, was cheerfully unsophisticated. "Turner, idiotic." He preferred such sentimental artists as Murillo and Gustave Doré, despite the latter's tendency to paint by the square mile. A week in Paris, dining deliciously and exploring the caverns of the Louvre, 5 days in a Venetian palace, with evening rides through the water streets and balcony breakfasts shared with pigeons, an afternoon spent under the immense cool vaulted arches of Milan Cathedral, 4 days in the marbled splendor of the Villa d'Este on Lake Como, then north in a rented carriage for a tour of the Alps. Alice, riding on horseback, accompanied Theodore up a fair-sized mountain near Samaden, and in consequence spent the next several days nursing various tender areas of her person. During this lull, early in July, news came that President Garfield had been shot and was lying in a coma from which he was unlikely to recover. "Frightful calamity for America," wrote Theodore in his diary, adding, "This means work in the future for those who wish their country well." The assassination of President Garfield was only the latest in a series of political explosions that shook America in the spring and summer of 1881, and whose rumblings followed Theodore across the Atlantic. Fuses had been lit the year before at the Republican National Convention, when the party went into deadlock over the nomination of its presidential candidate. Senator Conkling's machine-minded stalwarts, who had grown rich on patronage under Grant and suffered under the righteous Hayes, wanted the general back in the White House. More independent, but equally corrupt, half-breeds were united in support of James G. Blaine. It had taken 26 ballots before James A. Garfield was nominated as an unpopular compromise. Both factions smoldered in resentment through his election and inauguration in March 1881. Then the first explosion occurred. In an uncanny repetition of the events of 1877, Garfield named a reform Republican to the collectorship of customs for the port of New York, just as Hayes before him had named Theodore Sr. Boss Conkling was so enraged by this second presidential slap in the face that on 16 May he resigned his Senate seat, confident that his lieutenants and the New York State Legislature would re-elect him and shame Garfield into withdrawing the appointment. No senator had ever offered so dramatic a challenge to a president, and Theodore, anxiously devouring French and Italian newspapers, kept abreast of developments as best he could. For a while, it seemed that the boss might win. But then a madman's bullet shattered both Garfield's spine and Conkling's chances. While the president lay dying, Conkling became, by popular consent, the arch-villain who had plotted his assassination. This rumor was false. Party leaders in Albany, however, were forced to elect another senator. A final stroke of irony, which Theodore had leisure to ponder in his Alpine retreat, was that Garfield's heir apparent was Vice President Chester A. Arthur, the very man whom Theodore Sr. had been groomed to replace in 1877. Boss Conkling might be out of power, but as long as his father's old rival sat in the White House, Theodore would be reminded of the uninterrupted power of the machine. Moving on through Austria and Bavaria, the young man had opportunity to exercise his linguistic abilities, translating German into Italian for the benefit of the carriage driver, and both into English for the benefit of Alice. They found the summer heat of the Bavarian lowlands stifling, and by mid-July, Theodore was climbing mountains again. In a period of 10 days, he walked up Pilatus, leaving an exhausted guide halfway down, the Rigi Grindelwald, and the Jungfrau, confessing only that he felt rather tired after the latter. Then, having refreshed himself with a 21-mile hike from Visp to Zermatt, he focused his eager spectacles on the Matterhorn. The notorious 15,000-foot peak curved into the sky like a giant scimitar, so steeply pointed that snow either slid off it or blew away in alpine gales. Unconquered until 1865, the Matterhorn possessed for Theodore a certain somber interest from the number of people that have lost their lives on it. This, plus the prestige he would win as one of the few unskilled climbers to ascend it, was enough to tempt him, and the presence of two British mountaineers in his hotel acted as a further goad. Determined to prove that he could climb as well as they could, he set off with two guides on the morning of 5 August. At 6 o'clock in the evening, we reached the small hut, half a cavern, where we spent the night. It was on the face of a cliff, up which we climbed by a rope 40 feet long, and the floor was covered with ice a foot deep. We left the hut at 3:40 a.m., and after seeing a most glorious sunrise, which crowned the countless snow peaks and billowy white clouds with a strange crimson iridescence, reached the summit at 7, and were down at the foot of the Matterhorn proper by 1. It was like going up and down enormous stairs on your hands and knees for 9 hours. During the journey, I was nearer giving out than on the Jungfrau, but I was not nearly so tired afterwards. Having had his fill of exercise for a while, Theodore turned now to mental activity. The manuscript of That Favorite Chateau en Espagne of Mine, The Naval War of 1812, formed a bulky part of the Roosevelt luggage, and he worked at it doggedly during his last month in Europe. You would be amused, he told Bammy from The Hague, to see me writing it here. I have plenty of information now, but I can't get it into words. I'm afraid it is too big a task for me. I wonder if I won't find everything in life too big for my abilities. Well, time will tell. On 10 September, the travelers reached Liverpool, laden with Parisian fashions and presents from the best London shops. Here Theodore's blessed old sea captain uncle, Irvine Bullock, helped untangle some of the nautical knots in his manuscript. The young author's confidence returned, and he found himself looking forward to the resumption of his legal, literary, and political work in New York. Summarizing his third trip abroad in 12 years, Theodore wrote Bill Sewell, I have enjoyed it greatly, yet the more I see, the better satisfied I am that I am an American, free-born and free-bred, where I acknowledge no man as my superior except for his own worth, or as my inferior except for his own demerit. In this healthy frame of mind, and feeling superbly healthy in body, the conqueror of the Matterhorn arrived back in New York on 2 October 1881. He lost no time in resuming his tripartite life, although a diary entry for 17 October indicates that his priorities had changed. Am working fairly hard at my law, hard at politics, and hardest of all at my book. Indeed, Theodore's interest in the first of these activities was steadily waning. He would continue to attend Columbia Law School lectures, on and off, for at least another year, and acquire, almost against his will, a semi-professional mastery of civil and criminal procedure, corporate and constitutional law, labor contracts, and cross-examination techniques, all highly useful to him in later life. But he found his current ambitions better served, and his soul more soothed, by the contrasted pleasures of politicking and writing. From 6 October to 8 November, it was the former activity that prevailed, since the 21st District was going through its annual throes of returning an assemblyman to Albany. Theodore did not want to miss a moment of the rough and tumble. He plunged aggressively into primary work, resolved to kill our last year's legislator, who was up for renomination. The legislator's name was William Trimble. Like all of Jake Hess's hand-picked assemblymen, he was a loyal servant of the machine and a stalwart through and through. This alone would have been enough to prejudice Theodore against him. The fact that Trimble had voted to oppose his pet cause, the street-cleaning bill, added a personal zest to the fight. Accordingly, Theodore worked energetically on behalf of independent delegates, and on 24 October, at the pre-convention meeting in Morton Hall, he stood up to make a formal protest against Trimble's renomination. Hess listened from behind his pitcher of iced water with the bland patience of a leader who is sure of his delegates. Neither he nor the speaker was aware that the same thoughtful eyes which had rested on Theodore earlier in the year were resting on him again, and that by now their gaze was beady. The eyes belonged to Joe Murray, one of Hess's Irish lieutenants. Burly, red-faced, taciturn, and shrewd, Murray had his own reasons to stop Trimble, more complex ones than Theodore's. He had been raised in barefoot poverty on First Avenue and emerged in his teens as the leader of a street gang. In this capacity, he had been employed, on a freelance basis, to influence the course of local elections with his fists. Although he worked in alternate years for both Republicans and Democrats, his blows on behalf of the former party carried more conviction, so to speak, than those for the latter. And in his early 20s, he had been rewarded with the job of ward healer at Morton Hall. Having thus literally punched his way into politics, Murray revealed unexpected gifts for party organization and moved up quietly through the ranks until now, in his mid-30s, he stood at Hess's elbow. Being a philosophical man, he tolerated his leader's arrogance and vanity, content to build up support within the association until the time was ripe to make a drive at him. It had been too early to do that in the spring, when Murray had joined Hess in crushing Theodore's support of the street cleaning bill, but he had not forgotten the young man's courage and outspokenness. During the summer, events had conspired to keep Roosevelt in his mind. The resignation of Boss Conkling and the assassination of President Garfield caused a public outcry against machine politics in general, and stalwarts in particular. Since Assemblyman Trimble was both, he had been tainted by this unpopularity, and Murray's street instinct warned that if Trimble stood for re-election, the 21st might fall to the Democrats. But when the Irishman expressed his misgivings, Hess had reacted contemptuously. "He'll be nominated anyway. You don't amount to anything." This was one insult too many for Murray. Unknown to Hess, he had already lined up enough delegates to nominate anybody he chose. All he lacked was a candidate. Two nights later, as he sat listening to Theodore speak at the pre-convention meeting, he realized that he had found one. Here was a candidate to beat Trimble, humiliate Hess, and convince the electorate that the bad old days of republicanism were over. This boy bore the name of one of New York's most revered philanthropists. As an Ivy League man, he could be counted on to bring in the swells and the Columbia crowd. As a Knickerbocker, he would generate funds along Fifth Avenue. He was obviously naive and untrained in politics, but that should prove an advantage on the hustings. His manners were pleasing, his face open and ingenuous, and he positively glowed with righteousness. He would be independent of any machine, immune to all bribes. He was honest, elegant, humorous, and a born fighter. What was more, he obviously enjoyed getting up on a chair and shouting at people. Murray decided it was Theodore Roosevelt or no one. At the end of the meeting, he drew the young man aside and told him that he, too, was opposed to the renomination of Trimble. Casually, the Irishman said that he had been looking around for another candidate and thought his search might be over. "No, I wouldn't dream of such a thing," Theodore said. "It would look as if I had selfish motives in coming around to oppose this man." Murray could interpret a coy expression as well as anybody. "Well, get me a desirable candidate." "Oh, you won't have any trouble," replied Theodore, and offered to look for one himself. The following evening they met again, and Theodore had to admit that he had not found a candidate. But he was still sure he could do so. With only 3 days to go before the convention, Murray grew impatient. "Mr. Roosevelt, in case we can't get a suitable candidate, will you take the nomination?" Theodore hesitated. "Yes, but I don't want it." He was privately suspicious of Murray's motives and went to seek the reassurance of a mutual friend, Edward Mitchell. "Joe is not in the habit of making statements that he cannot make good," Mitchell told him. "You have fallen in very good hands." On 28 October 1881, the Assembly Convention met at Morton Hall. Murray sat patiently through a 45-minute speech nominating Assemblyman Trimble. Then he rose and simply said, "Mr. Chairman, I nominate Theodore Roosevelt." The convention voted in his favor on the first ballot, with a majority of 16-9. Theodore was just 23 years and 1 day old. Late that night, the nominee wrote in his diary, "My platform is strong Republican on state matters, but independent on local and municipal affairs." Thus, at the very outset of his political career, he managed to balance party loyalty with personal freedom. The platform he chose was an unstable one, yet he had already found its center of gravity. For the next 4 decades, he would occupy that motionless spot, while the rest of the platform tipped giddily backward and forward, left and right. Confronted with Theodore's nomination as a fait accompli, the Roosevelt family rallied to his support with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Wealthy friends of his father offered to help with campaign expenses and published an open letter testifying to his high character, honesty, and integrity. The list of signatures on this document, which read like a combination of the Social Register and Banker's Directory, included that of the eminent lawyer Elihu Root, yet another of Theodore's future secretaries of state. Press comment on the nomination was mostly favorable. "Every good citizen has cause for rejoicing," declared the New York Times, "that the Republicans of the 21st Assembly District have united upon so admirable a candidate for the Assembly as Mr. Theodore Roosevelt. Mr. Roosevelt needs no introduction to his constituency. His family has been long and honorably known as one of the foremost in this city, and Mr. Roosevelt himself is a public-spirited citizen, not an office-seeker, but one of the men who should be sought for office." The newspaper went on to note that as Theodore's district was naturally Republican, he could look forward to a handsome majority in the election. This fact may also have been realized by the Democrats. Their candidate was a Dr. W. W. Strew, recently fired from the directorship of Blackwell's Island Lunatic Asylum. Theodore himself had no doubt that he would be elected. His campaign circular, dated 1 November 1881, was so brief and bare of promises as to seem almost arrogant. "Dear Sir, having been nominated as a candidate for Member of Assembly for this district, I would esteem it as a compliment if you would honor me with your vote and personal influence on Election Day. Very respectfully, Theodore Roosevelt." After decades of flowery political appeals, this simple message came as a welcome surprise to the electorate. For all the favorable trends, Theodore's 8-day campaign was not without its anxious moments. Joe Murray and Jake Hess, who had philosophically agreed to support the Assembly Convention's decision, soon discovered that their candidate had an alarming tendency to speak his mind. It was fortunate that they accompanied him on a personal canvass of the saloons of Sixth Avenue, or, as Theodore recalled in his autobiography, the liquor vote might have been lost. "The canvass did not last beyond the first saloon. I was introduced with proper solemnity to the saloon keeper, a very important personage, for this was before the days when saloon keepers became merely the mortgaged chattels of the brewers, and he began to cross-examine me, a little too much in the tone of one who was dealing with a suppliant for his favor. He said that he expected that I would, of course, treat the liquor business fairly, to which I answered, none too cordially, that I hoped I should treat all interests fairly. He then said that he regarded the licenses as too high, to which I responded that I believed that they were really not high enough, and that I should try to have them made higher. The conversation threatened to become stormy. Messrs. Murray and Hess, on some hastily improvised plea, took me out into the street, and then Joe explained to me that it was not worth my while staying in Sixth Avenue any longer, that I had better go right back to Fifth Avenue and attend to my friends there, and that he would look after my interests on Sixth Avenue. I was triumphantly elected." Theodore received the news of his victory, 3,490 votes to Strew's 1,989, almost double the usual Republican margin, distractedly. After voting on the morning of 9 November, he had retired to the library at 6 West 57th Street and busied himself with his book, which was due at Putnam's by Christmas. Not until an admirer called, wishing to meet the rising star, did he accept the fact that he was now a professional politician. This sudden change in status seems only to have increased his determination to become, simultaneously, a professional writer. He spent the rest of November working with total absorption on his manuscript, and by 3 December it was in the hands of the publisher. The Naval War of 1812, which appeared some 5 months later, was the first and in some ways the most enduring of Theodore Roosevelt's 38 books. Reviewers were almost unanimous in their praise of its scholarship, sweep, and originality. It was recognized on both sides of the Atlantic as the last word on the subject, and a classic of naval history. Within 2 years of publication, it went through 3 editions and became a textbook at several colleges. In 1886, by special regulation, at least one copy was ordered placed on board every U.S. Navy vessel. 11 years later, when Great Britain was preparing her own official history of the Royal Navy, the editors paid Theodore the unprecedented compliment of asking him to write the section of that work dealing with the War of 1812. For almost a century, naval war would remain the definitive work in its field. Considering the author's youth, he was 21 when he began it and just 23 when he finished, his frequent ill health and many distractions, the book may be considered an extraordinary achievement. Its merits are as simple as those of any serious piece of academic writing. Clarity, accuracy, and completeness backed by massive documentation. The density of research is such that Theodore often quotes a different authority for every sentence. His impartiality in weighing facts and reaching conclusions is remarkable in view of his burgeoning Americanism. Sentiment is never allowed to interfere with statistics. Admittedly, the first chapters do not make for fascinating reading. The 32-gun frigates, presented in broadsides, 13 long 12s below, and 7 24-pound carronades above. The 38-gun frigates, 14 long 18s below, and 10 32-pound carronades above. So that a 44-gun frigate would naturally present 15 long 24s below and 12 42-pound carronades above, as the United States did at first. And so on, for dozens of pages. Clearly, he is out to inform, not entertain. And it must be admitted that his own criticism of it as dry is justified. The first two chapters, however masterly in their compilation and assortment of figures, are unreadable by all except the most dedicated naval strategists, and the other eight are almost as severe. There is something almost inhuman about the young author's refusal to swashbuckle, taste the triumphs of victory and the pain of defeat, and dramatize character where well he might. Yet there twinkles every now and again in its gray pages a flash of sarcastic humor, usually at the expense of historians less scholarly than he. James states that she, the United States, had but one boy aboard, and that he was 17 years old, in which case 29 others, some of whom, as we learn from The Life of Decatur, were only 12, must have grown with truly startling rapidity during the hour and a half the combat lasted. Elsewhere, he observes that James's remark on the similarity of language spoken by both sides is an interesting philological discovery that but few will attempt to controvert. In his search for truth, he does not hesitate to crush such sentimental legends as that of the Battle of Lake Erie. The glory acquired by it most certainly has been estimated at more than its own worth, he declares in the course of a long and brilliantly detailed analysis. The simple truth is, the side which possessed the superiority in force in the proportion of 3-2 could not well help winning. Dismissing stereotyped arguments that the United States fleet was underarmed and undermanned, he went on to prove, with incontestable figures, that its weight of ammunition, i.e. fighting effectiveness, was superior, as the battle was fought under very short sail and decided purely by gunnery. Theodore's very scrupulousness, however, led him to the conclusion that the naval war of 1812 was a deserved victory for America. Having so decided, he felt no desire to gloat, for a far more important theme preoccupied him. That if the conflict were to be repeated in 1882, the result would undoubtedly be the reverse. The small, efficient, and technically advanced navy of 1812 was now large, unwieldy, and obsolescent. Writing his preface to the first edition, the young author suddenly cast aside his cloak of academic impartiality and revealed that he was wearing military uniform underneath. "It is folly," thundered Theodore, "for the great English-speaking republic to rely for defense upon a navy composed partly of antiquated hulks and partly of new vessels rather more worthless than the old." He urged his compatriots to study with some care that period of our history during which our navy stood at the highest pitch of its fame. To learn anything from the past, it is necessary to know, as near as may be, the exact truth, if only from the narrowest motives. Strategic experts pondered his message, at least as far away as Washington, D.C. The naval war of 1812 was to have a profound effect upon the attitude of the country to its navy, not to mention Theodore's future career. Within 3 days after delivering his manuscript to Putnam's, Theodore was caught up in the whirl and glitter of the new social season. "The going out has fairly begun," he noted on 6 December. "All are at it, from dinners to balls." He saw that Alice, who had no doubt felt rather neglected in recent months, had her fill of the festivities. She would be seeing even less of him in the new year, when the legislative session began at Albany. Until his election, they had been thinking of moving into their own house sometime that winter. But now the prospect of leaving her alone for weeks at a time, although he would try to get married Diggs in Albany so she could come north occasionally, convinced him they should stay on at 6 West 57th Street. The session would be over in the spring, and they would look for a new home then. As to his future beyond that, Theodore professed to be as vague as ever. "Too true, too true. I have become a political hack," he wrote to an ex-classmate. But don't think I am going into politics after this year, for I am not. Chapter 6. The Cyclone Assemblyman. Through the streets of Drontheim strode he red and wrathful, with his stately air. Assemblyman Theodore Roosevelt arrived in Albany in 17-degree weather, late on the afternoon of Monday, 2 January, 1882. Alice had gone to Montreal with a party of friends, and would not be joining him for another 2 weeks. They could look for lodgings then. In the meantime, he checked into the Delavan House, a rambling old hotel with whistly radiators immediately opposite the railroad station. Apart from the fact that it was conveniently located and boasted one of the few good restaurants in town, the Delavan was honeycombed with seedy private rooms of the kind that politicians love to fill with smoke. Hence, it functioned as the unofficial headquarters of both Republicans and Democrats during the legislative season. The assembly was not due to open until the following morning, but Roosevelt had been asked to attend a preliminary caucus of Republicans in the Capitol that evening for the purpose of nominating their candidate for Speaker. He thus had only an hour or two to unpack, change, and prepare to meet his colleagues. Dusk came early, as always in Albany, for the little city straggles up the right bank of the Hudson and is screened off from the plateau above by a 200-foot escarpment of blue clay. But the western sky was clear and lit by a rising full moon when Roosevelt emerged from the Delavan House and began his walk to the Capitol. At first he could not see that building, as it was locally known, for he had to walk south along the river for a block or two before ascending State Street. Yet already he was moving in its monstrous shadow. Roosevelt had probably read, in his Albany handbook, that the new Capitol was, by common consent, one of the architectural wonders of the 19th century. Whether it was a thing of beauty or not was questionable, but there was no doubt, as the handbook said, that it was the grandest legislative building of modern times. Roosevelt's first glimpse of the $11 million structure, as he rounded the corner of State and Broadway and focused his pince-nez uptown, was a thrilling one. Still not quite finished, the stupendous pile of white granite towered out of mounds of construction rubble at the very top of the hill. The old Capitol, a Greek revival hall awaiting demolition, stood a little farther down, obscuring some of Roosevelt's view, yet its dark silhouette merely accentuated the brilliantly lit massiveness looming behind. Jagged against the skyline rose an improbable forest of steeples, turrets, dormers, and gables, all gleaming in the moonlight, for a snowfall the day before had exquisitely etched them out. An architect surveying the Capitol's five stories could successively trace the influence of Romanesque, Italian Renaissance, and French Renaissance styles, with layers of Arabesque in between. But to an untutored eye, such as Roosevelt's, the overall effect was of imperial Indian majesty. Perhaps for the first time, the young assemblyman realized that, as a New York State legislator, he now represented a commonwealth more populous than most of Europe's kingdoms, rich enough and industrious enough to rank alongside any great power. Inspiring as the sight of his destination was, Roosevelt had to concentrate, for the moment, on the tricky business of getting up there without falling down. The steep sidewalks of State Street, when slicked with frozen snow, were notoriously dangerous, and that night blasts of icy air over the escarpment made them doubly so. All sane assemblymen, of course, were taking horse cars in this weather, but any such indulgence was abhorrent to Roosevelt. Although the wind chill factor was well below zero, he wore no overcoat. A man thus unprotected, yet well stoked with Delavan House coffee, might be able to negotiate two or three blocks of State Street without pain. But he will begin to throb before he is halfway to the top, and Roosevelt was undoubtedly hurting in every extremity by the time he crested the hill and ducked into the warmth of the Capitol lobby. As the pain faded to a glow and his lenses defrosted, he could make out a labyrinth of stone passages and ground glass doors, through which came the busy clacking of typewriting machines. He was standing on the clerical floor. The halls of power, presumably, were somewhere overhead. To his left, the assembly staircase beckoned. 100 rapid steps elevated him to the second floor, and the famous golden corridor opened out before him. Unquestionably the most sumptuous stretch of interior design in the United States, it formed a dwindling perspective of gilded arches and gorgeously painted pillars. High gas globes picked out the filigree on walls of crimson, umber, yellow, and deep blue, and cast pockets of violet shadow into every alcove. Jardinières of exotics, freshly planted to mark the beginning of the legislative season, perfumed the air. Roosevelt might well have imagined himself in Moorish Granada, were it not for a very American hubbub coming from a door at the far end of the corridor. Here, 52 other Republican assemblymen awaited him in caucus. To say that Theodore Roosevelt made a vivid first impression upon his colleagues would hardly be an exaggeration. From the moment that he appeared in their midst, there was a chorus of incredulous and delighted comment. Memories of his entrance that night, transcribed many years later, vary as to time and place, but all share the common image of a young man bursting through a door and pausing for an instant while all eyes were upon him, an actor's trick that quickly became habitual. This gave his audience time to absorb the full brilliancy of his Savile Row clothes and furnishings. The recollections of one John Walsh may be taken as typical. Suddenly our eyes, and those of everybody on the floor, became glued on a young man who was coming in through the door. His hair was parted in the center, and he had sideburns. He wore a single eyeglass with a gold chain over his ear. He had on a cutaway coat with one button at the top, and the ends of its tails almost reached the tops of his shoes. He carried a gold-heeled cane in one hand, a silk hat in the other, and he walked in the bent-over fashion that was the style with the young men of the day. His trousers were as tight as a tailor could make them, and he had a bell-shaped bottom to cover his shoes. "Who's the dude?" I asked another member, while the same question was being put in a dozen different parts of the hall. "That's Theodore Roosevelt of New York," he answered. Notwithstanding this ready identification, the newcomer quickly became known as Oscar Wilde, after the famous fop who, coincidentally, had arrived in America earlier the same day. At 23, Roosevelt was the youngest man in the legislature, recognized not only for his boyishness, but for his elastic movements, voluminous laughter, and wealth of mouth. More bitter epithets were to follow in the months ahead, as he proved himself to be something of an angrily buzzing fly in the Republican ointment. Young Squirt, Weakling, Punkin' Lily, and Jane Dandy were some of the milder ones.
"He's just a damn fool," growled old Tom Alvord, who had been Speaker of the House the day Roosevelt was born.
Nominated again for Speaker that night, Alvord cynically assessed Republican strength in the House as 60 1/2 members. Roosevelt had return epithets of his own, and began to record them in a private legislative diary immediately after the 2 January caucus. At first, they were merely superficial, revealing him to be as class-conscious as his detractors. But as time went by, and the shabbiness of New York State politics, so at odds with the splendors of the Capitol, became clear to him, his pen jabbed the paper with increasing fury. "There are some 25 Irish Democrats in the House," the young Knickerbocker wrote. "They are a stupid, sodden, vicious lot, most of them being equally deficient in brains and virtue." 8 Tammany Hall Democrats, representing the machine element, drew his especial contempt, being totally unable to speak with even an approximation to good grammar. Not even one of them can string 3 intelligible sentences together to save his neck. Roosevelt's bête noire, and the feeling was reciprocated, was a gentleman named McManus, a huge, fleshy, unutterably coarse and low brute, who was formerly a prize-fighter, at present keeps a low drinking and dancing saloon, and is more than suspected of having begun his life as a pickpocket. He was hardly less severe on members of his own party. Ex-Speaker Alvord he instantly dismissed as a bad old fellow, corrupt. Another colleague was smooth, oily, plausible, and tricky. Yet another was entirely unprincipled, with the same idea of public life and civil service that a vulture has of a dead sheep. His contempt dwindled reciprocally according to the idealism and independence of the younger members, in other words, those most like himself. Although they could be counted on the fingers of one hand, Roosevelt instinctively sought them out. One in particular caught his eye. A tall, thin, melancholy country lawyer from Jefferson, thoroughly upright and honest, and a man of some parts. The melancholy youth was named Isaac Hunt. He, too, was serving his first term in the Assembly. But the two freshmen did not get to meet for several days, owing to a strange state of political paralysis in the House. The situation was succinctly summarized in Roosevelt's diary of 3 January.
The legislature has assembled in full force, 128 assemblymen, containing 61 Republicans in their ranks, and 8 Tammany men among the 67 Democrats. Tammany thus holds the balance of power, and as the split between her and the regular democracy is very bitter, a long deadlock is promised us. His forecast proved correct. The very first piece of business before the House, electing a new speaker, was stalled by the Tammany members, who refused to give their crucial block of votes to either of the major party nominees. Thus, each candidate was kept just short of the 64 votes required to win. Clearly, the holdouts hoped that one side or the other would eventually make a deal with them, and that the elected speaker would reward Tammany with some plum committee jobs. Until then, with nobody in the chair, there could be no parliamentary procedure and no legislation. For the first week in Albany, Roosevelt had nothing to do except trudge daily up State Street and answer the roll call in the assembly chamber. Then, there being no further business, he would trudge back to the Delavan House and meditate on the stupid and monotonous work of politics. Albany was an unattractive place to be bored in, a little old Dutch burg separated from New York by 145 miles of chilly river valley. Back home in Manhattan, the social season was at its height, and Fifth Avenue was alive with the sounds of witty conversation and ballroom music. Here, it was so quiet at night, the only sound in the streets was the clicking of telephone wires. There were, of course, several disorderly houses for the convenience of legislators, but such places revolted him. To vent his surplus energy, he went for long walks around town, but the local air was insalubrious, even to a man with healthy lungs. Depending on the vagaries of the breeze, his nostrils were saluted with the sour effluvia of 20 breweries, choking fumes from the coal tar and dye chemical works, and brackish smells from the river. Only on rare occasions did chill, pure Canadian air find its way down from the north, bringing with it the piney scent of lumber yards. Escaping to New York for his first weekend, Roosevelt put on a cheerful front, but it was plain that his first exposure to government had depressed him. With Alice still away, she had gone to Boston to visit her parents, Elliot abroad, and Mittie sweetly uncomprehending, he unburdened himself to Aunt Annie, mother confessor to all young Roosevelts. The little lady, now married to a banker, James K. Gracie, held court in her brownstone at 26 West 36th Street, surrounded by Bibles and fruitcake. It was on her knee that Teddy had learned his ABCs, and early displayed his contempt for arithmetic. Now, 20 years later, Assemblyman Roosevelt returned to complain about Albany. "We talked of his book," she wrote Elliot, "and his political interests. Thee thinks these will only help him in giving him some fame. But neither, he says, will be of practical value in his profession. He says he must begin again at the beginning in the spring, having gained this intermediate experience." These remarks, and the young man's earlier avowal, "Don't think I am going into politics after this year, for I am not," might be taken with a pinch of salt. Throughout his life, in moments of triumph as well as despair, he would continue to insist he had no future in politics. Relatives and friends soon learned to ignore such protestations, knowing very well that they were insincere or, at best, self-delusive. Theodore Roosevelt was addicted to politics from the moment he won his first election until long after he lost his last. The weekend in New York was sufficiently recuperative for him to bounce back to Albany on Monday, 9 January, with optimistic energy. There was another Republican caucus that night, and although it dealt with the less than fascinating subject of the appointment of assembly clerks, Roosevelt conscientiously attended. This time, he was in even greater sartorial splendor, having dined out somewhere beforehand. Isaac Hunt, the melancholy member from Jefferson County, was standing by the fireplace in the committee room when in bolted Teddy, as if ejected from a catapult. Deliberately selecting the most prominent position in the room, directly in front of the chairman, Roosevelt sat down and pulled off his ulster. Underneath, he was in full evening dress, with gold fob and chain. At the first opportunity, he jumped to his feet and addressed the meeting in the affected drawl of Harvard and Fifth Avenue. "We almost shouted with laughter," Hunt remembered, "to think that the most veritable representative of the New York dude had come to the chamber." But as Roosevelt continued to speak, our attention was drawn upon what he had to say, because there was a force in his remarks. It mollified somewhat his unusual appearance. Roosevelt was about to sit down again when he caught sight of Hunt by the fireplace. Instantly, he made his way over to him. Hunt, too, as it happened, was overdressed. He was sensitive about his rural background and had invested in a custom-made Prince Albert coat by way of disguise. He might as well have saved his money.
"You," shrilled Roosevelt triumphantly, "are from the country."
For the rest of that evening, he interrogated Hunt on the minutiae of rural politics. His usual practice, after such an interview, was to discard his victim like a well-sucked orange. But something about the young lawyer appealed to him. Hunt, in turn, was charmed. At the end of the caucus, the two assemblymen parted fast friends. Roosevelt had recruited his first legislative ally. For the next 5 weeks, there was nothing substantial to be allied against. The deadlock over electing a speaker seemed unresolvable. Roosevelt continued to vent his impatience with vitriolic diary entries and walks that ranged farther and farther out of Albany. He persuaded his new friend to join him on one of these excursions. The long-legged lawyer came back too tired to speak and went straight to bed. When Roosevelt suggested another tramp, Hunt begged off. "You will have to get somebody else to walk with you. One dose is sufficient for me." On the second weekend of the session, Roosevelt went to Boston to pick up the Little Pink Wife, as he was wont to call her. They chose rooms together in a residential hotel on the corner of Eagle and State Streets, just across the square from the Capitol. Isaac Hunt had rooms there, too, and saw much of both of them. "She was a very charming woman, tall, willowy-looking. I was very much taken with her." Some older members of the legislature were less and less taken with Roosevelt. Time, as the deadlock dragged on, hung heavy on their hands, and they began to plot his humiliation. Chief among the bullies was Big John McManus, the ex-prizefighter and Tammany lieutenant whom Roosevelt had so contemptuously characterized in his diary. One day, McManus proposed to toss "that damned dude" in a blanket for reasons having vaguely to do with the dude's side whiskers. Fortunately, Roosevelt got advance warning. His feelings with Alice newly installed in Albany may well be imagined. Marching straight up to McManus, who towered over him, he hissed, "I hear you are going to toss me in a blanket. By God, if you try anything like that, I'll kick you, I'll bite you, I'll kick you in the balls, I'll do anything to you. You'd better leave me alone." This speech had the desired effect. There was a second ugly incident, which proved conclusively that Roosevelt was not to be trifled with. Sporting a cane, doeskin gloves, and the style of short pea jacket popularly known in England as a bum freezer, he went walking along Washington Avenue with Hunt and William O'Neill, another young Republican assemblyman. They stopped at a saloon for refreshments and were confronted by the tall, taunting figure of J.J. Costello, a Tammany member. Some insult to do with the pea jacket, legend quotes it as, "Won't Mama's boy catch cold?" caused Roosevelt to flare up. "Teddy knocked him down," Hunt recalled admiringly. "And he got up and he hit him again. And when he got up, he hit him again. And he said, 'Now you go over there and wash yourself. When you are in the presence of gentlemen, conduct yourself like a gentleman.'" "I'm not going to have an Irishman or anybody else insult me," Roosevelt said later, still bristling. Now that he and Alice were cozily settled in Albany, his impatience over the deadlock dwindled. It occurred to him that, on the whole, the situation was politically profitable. Since only the infighting of Tammany Hall and regular Democrats prevented the election of a speaker, nobody could blame the Republicans for holding up legislation. The longer the deadlock persisted, he reasoned, the better his party would look, and the more likely its chances of winning a majority in the next election. On 24 January 1882, he had an opportunity to present this view in the Assembly chamber. A well-meaning colleague was suggesting that the minority compromise with the majority and so overwhelm the maverick vote of Tammany Hall. Roosevelt leaped up in silent protest, and the clerk, acting in lieu of a speaker, recognized him for the first time. No future president has made his maiden speech in surroundings as inspiring as those framing Theodore Roosevelt that afternoon. Since its completion only 3 years before, the New York State Assembly Chamber had been acclaimed as the most magnificent legislative hall in the world. Its splendor surpassed even those of the Golden Corridor. "What a great thing to have done in this country," John Hay had marveled, gazing up at the fabulous vaulted ceiling, a dizzy canopy of vermilion and blue and gold, cleft by ribs of soaring stone. 50 feet above Roosevelt's head as he prepared to speak, hung a 3-ton ring of granite, keystone of the largest groined arch ever built. Behind him, on the north wall, loomed a vast allegorical mural by William Morris Hunt, The Flight of Evil Before Good. With pleasing symbolism, it depicted the Queen of Night on a chariot of dark clouds, being driven away by the radiance of dawn. Roosevelt's words were, in contrast to this majestic auditorium, deliberately informal, even prosaic. He did not forget that his audience consisted largely of farmers, liquor sellers, bricklayers, butchers, tobacconists, pawnbrokers, compositors, and carpenters. His voice was thin and squeaky as he struggled against the chamber's notorious acoustics and a general hum of bored conversation.
"It has been said that if Democrats do not organize the House speedily, the Republicans will interfere and perfect the organization. I should very much doubt the expediency of doing this at present."
A newspaperman was struck by Roosevelt's novel way of inflating his lungs. Between phrases, he would open his mouth in a convulsive gasp, dragging the air in by main force. Clearly his asthma was troubling him. At times, the slight stammer which friends had noticed at Harvard intruded, and his teeth would knock together as the words fought their way out. "He spoke as if he had an impediment in his speech," said Hunt. "He would open his mouth and run out his tongue. But what he said was all right."
"As things are today in New York, there are two branches of Jeffersonian Democrats. Neither of these alone can carry the state against the Republicans. I do not think they can fairly expect us to join with either section. This is purely a struggle between themselves, and it should be allowed to continue as long as they please. We have no interest in helping one section against the other. Combined, they have the majority, and let them make all they can out of it."
There were some scattered bursts of applause, and Roosevelt began to relax.
"While in New York, I talked with several gentlemen who have large commercial interests at stake, and they do not seem to care whether the deadlock is broken or not. In fact, they seem rather relieved. And if we do no business till February 15th, I think the voters of the state will worry along through without it."
Having said his piece, he abruptly sat down and was inundated with many hearty congratulations from the older members. Among these, to his intense amusement, were several representatives of Tammany Hall, who apparently thought he had been speaking on their behalf. That night, the New York Evening Post reported that he had made a very favorable impression, an opinion which Roosevelt himself modestly shared. He was less flattered with the Sun's characterization of him next morning as a blonde young man with eyeglasses, English side whiskers, and a Dundreary drawl. The paper noted sarcastically that Roosevelt's maiden effort as an orator had been applauded by his political opponents. There was a reference to his quaint pronunciation of the words, "rather relieved." Nevertheless, the speech was successful. Roosevelt's advice was accepted by his party, and the deadlock continued. Early in February, the Tammany holdouts finally gave in, and Charles Patterson, Democratic candidate for Speaker, was elected. Announcing his committees on 14 February, Patterson gave Roosevelt a position on cities. "Just where I wish to be," the young Republican exulted. He was not charmed with his mostly Democratic companions on the committee, one of whom was Big John McManus.
"Altogether, the committee is just about as bad as it could possibly be," he decided, with the wisdom of his 23 years. "Most of the members are positively corrupt, and the others are really singularly incompetent."
Roosevelt lost no time in making his presence felt on the floor of the House. Within 48 hours of his committee appointment, he had introduced 4 bills, one to purify New York's water supply, another to purify its election of aldermen, a third to cancel all stocks and bonds in the city's sinking fund, and a fourth to lighten the judicial burden on the Court of Appeals. The fact that only one of these, the Aldermanic Bill, ever achieved passage, and in a severely modified form, did not discourage him. He wanted quickly to create the image of a knight in shining armor opposing the Black Horse Cavalry, his term for machine politicians. As such, he attracted to his banner a tiny group of independent freshman Republicans, like Isaac Hunt and Billy O'Neill, who shared his crusading instincts but lacked his flamboyance. The group's efforts were given wide coverage by George Spinney, legislative correspondent of the New York Times, the first of many thousands of journalists to discover that Roosevelt made marvelous copy. The young reformers supplied their leader with research into suspicious legislation, advised him on correct parliamentary procedure, and attempted to suppress his more embarrassing displays of righteousness. Roosevelt's ebullience was amusingly recalled 40 years later